Hey, Reg. Change this microphone again. How you doing, my friend? Nice. Okay. I'm all set. I'm in a comfortable chair here. Microphone is right where it's supposed to be. Screen is on. We're all set. What do you say? How about making a podcast? All right. Let's do it then. You got your trigger finger ready? Good. Okay. Prepare. We're ready to start. Star, smile strong. Here comes your part now, Reggie. Hang on. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And where else would we be? And where else would you be? You better be here every Monday, scrolling down, clicking on, listening. But there's more for you to do as well. Not only should you be listening, you should be getting out there and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anybody who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. And don't forget, you can either rate this podcast and subscribe to it wherever you find it. This podcast needs to be your weekly priority. If you like what you hear, don't forget, you can go to WGNRadio.com, go to the podcast section, hit a prompt for this podcast, and be careful, because you may get what you ask for. Podcast after podcast, just keep scrolling down and loading more, scrolling down and loading more. After all, this is episode number 424. So, now, I don't usually get too much into politics, especially in today's world, because it is quite a divisive topic these days. And I've talked about this on many occasions. If you listen with any regularity, you should know where I stand on a lot of things. And a lot of it is just common sense, and as I say, I try to be as objective as possible. I'm not in one camp or the other. I try to present a realistic view of the situation, whether it be COVID, whether it be a myriad of different topics. As I've said, I was trained at the outset of my career as a reporter, as a journalist. And so I was taught to look at things from an objective view. Now, today's world and today's media and today's journalism does not do that. I understand that. I am a dinosaur. I am Jim Tyrannosaurus Rex. I get that. I'm a dinosaur. I still believe in objectivity. I still believe in checking sources. I still believe in reporting the facts, not the opinion. Now, granted, I'm giving opinion here, so but I'm not being hypocritical in that I'm offering an opinion to offer the objective view, because that doesn't seem to be getting through today. And the only reason that I'm even compelled to do this on this podcast is because of the scary and sad debacle that happened a week or so ago on national television, on international television, mind you. Of course, this was the debate between President Biden and Donald Trump. And Believe me, and I'm not even talking about politics now, per se. It'll be impossible not to, but I think there's a deeper meaning and a deeper issue here that has not come up yet, which, from personal experience, I'd like to share to offer my view. Once again, yes, I understand it's subjective, but it's my own experience, which we're not hearing a lot about. People have a lot of attitudes, people have a lot of opinions, but they're not based on their personal experience. When I watched this debate, almost from the first minute of the debate, I had an immediate flashback to something that occurred in my life. And as the debate went on, I wasn't watching it anymore as a political event. Like 99.9% of the percent of the people who were watching it were. And even a couple of weeks now, week and a half after it, there's still debates about the debate. And I've watched, and I told you many times, I am a political junkie. I love to watch. I watch all the political shows on Sunday. That's all I'm watching. I VCR them I DVR them because many of them are on at the same time. That's my Sunday watching. And all the stations, not just one. I watch Meet the Press. I watch Fox. I watch MSNBC. I watch CNN. I watch News Nation. I'm trying to get as many different views of the day's events as possible. And being a journalist at heart, I don't think once you start to look at the world from a very objective view as much as possible, don't get me wrong, as I've said, we all look at life through our own subjective prism and our own subjective lens and our own subjective life experience. I get that. But I also try as hard as I can to take a step back. And at the outset of this, let me just tell you, if this sounds like, oh, wow, Jim, you're really favoring one size to the other, please let me state this disclaimer at the beginning. Full disclosure. I am a registered Democrat, have been since I first voted when I was eligible at 18. I would consider myself liberal-minded. On one of the biggest issues of our day, and especially of this campaign, I would consider myself pro-choice. Now, I must also say that over the last 10 years, if not more, I've also felt like a man without a party. Yes, I am a registered Democrat. Yes, I do vote, but I don't vote along party lines and never have. I've always split my vote. I try to vote for the best person. Because ultimately, that's what you want in there. You want somebody that not always agrees with you, but you want somebody who you believe can make an educated, smart, and useful choice on something. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them, because that's their job, to do the background, to study this, to have staffs, to give them all this information. Now, what's sad is that so many of today's politicians, even if they have all this knowledge and all this background and all this data, they still seem to come out along their party line. But that's not the way that I view the world. As I said, to me, the world is not black and white. It's a deep shade of gray. Because I'm always, and I've said this many times, I'm always afraid of, always suspicious of absolutes. When someone says this is the way, this is right. We as much as we pretend to know things, we really don't know things. Oh, yes, we do know that 2 plus 2 is 4. I get that. But we don't know how, for instance, the universe was made. We've got theories. We've got theories that are based on some threads of evidence. But we don't know. We don't know if there's a God. We can believe it. If you have faith in that, I have no problem with that. But we don't know. Anybody who says they know there's a God, they know there's a heaven. Absolutes are what have gotten this world in trouble, because we are right now in a time when you can't even change anybody's mind on anything, because each side is absolutely correct in their mind. And so I try, at least in my life, in my views, to take a step back, to be an observer. Yes, I'm a part of this world. I'm a part of this species. I'm a part of this society. I'm a part of the culture. And yes, I do things that we all do. Right, I understand that. But there are times when I try to take a step back and look at it floating over the scene and just observing as if I don't have an opinion. We all have opinions on everything. I have very strong opinions on things. There's no question about that. But opinions and I guess what's the word I'm looking for? Stating them as absolute truths. That's where you get in trouble. We all have opinions because, as I said before, we all have experience. We all have done things. We've all learned things. But I'm the first to acknowledge that I don't have the knowledge of everything, and that when I'm making my opinions or making some observations, I'm doing it through the lens of my life experience and my life education, what I've learned either books or through observation, through schooling, or through living. But we have to be careful about the absolutes. As I've said many times, blind faith is scary. Blind faith in anything, in a person, in religion, in a government, if you give your complete support, unequivocal, to any type of person or institution, and you cannot and will not and don't believe you should question anything about it, that's when you get in trouble. That's when we collectively get in trouble. And we've seen it through history. So, as I said, half the time on this podcast, I try to offer you a distraction from the noise, the white noise, if you will, of what's going on in this very divided country of ours, and even in this very chaotic and unstable world of ours right now. We are living in a very difficult, complex time, and I've mentioned this many times. It's not going to be over in 6 months. There's no guarantees it may be over ever. We might be in a constant tumult for decades, for generations, because of the way our culture has, in quotes, progressed, or at the very least, moved forward because of technology. You cannot, I've said this many times, you cannot underestimate the power of social media. Because for the first time in the history of man, everybody has, and potentially, a voice. And those who are humanistic say that's why the greatest invention on earth was the internet and social media, because it gave everybody a voice. And yes, in an esoteric theoretical way, yeah, that is a move toward ultimate equality. But what those idealistic people, those idealists failed to compute into their equation was that it also would make for an abundance of opinions and noise. And yes, divisiveness. As a country in the United States, as a world, we are not that united. Because even when you look at an event like, say, 9/11, which you would say, wow, I mean, everybody has to be feel sorry for that. There were many people in this world who cheered that day. Right? So we are not and we never have been a United States of America, and we have never been a united world. The difference now in the last 15 years is that we are faced with it. We are exposing now just how divided we are amongst not just countries, not just religions, amongst people, amongst your next door neighbor. Everybody has a voice. It's a great advantage, but it's also been a detrimental liability. And that's what we're trying to figure out right now. That's why our world is so unstable, because there is no clear path. Every time there's some agreement, there's some disagreement to shut it down. It's hard for us to take steps forward in any direction, whatever side of the aisle you're on. Because as soon as you take a step forward, somebody is going to make a comment that can take you two steps back. And so I don't know about you, but I feel the last 15, 16 years since social media has really taken over, we've been in a quagmire in many ways. We haven't really moved forward at all. We're talking about the same issues. We're talking about solutions. But there haven't been many that have put into place and have actually had an influence or an impact. And I don't know if we can, and I don't know what the answer is. But I'm not here to give you answers, really. I'm here to at least try to strip away some, if you're in that camp, to perhaps try to at least separate yourself from whatever side you may be on and take a step back and observe. And I'll have to tell you, as I said, on this podcast, I talk about, deer in my yard and how I can't fix things around the house and all different little personal foibles of mine that I've tried to share because, you know, funny observations, silly, embarrassing things. As I said, to provide a distraction from all the craziness out there. But sometimes I believe it's possible. I mean, it's needed, at least from my standpoint, to offer at least another view of what is going on out there. I'm still trying to provide a distraction to some extent, because I'm trying to offer an alternative view of what we're hearing for the most part on a big issue. And don't worry, next podcast, I'll probably be talking about something just as silly and stupid and fun and goofy and Elton Jimish as always. But I have to tell you, when I watched this debate, I was sad. I wasn't angry. I wasn't shocked. I was sad. Because as I said earlier, it immediately took me back to to something in my life that continues to have a profound influence on me, even though it happened almost 20 years ago. In fact, it actually happened more than 20 years ago. The resolution of it hasn't yet been 20 years, but the beginning of it is over 20 years ago now. And when I watched that debate, it wasn't a debate. It was a debacle. Let's be honest. And even those most staunch supporters of President Biden, those most staunch supporters of the Democratic Party, those most staunch evangelists of anti-Trump sentiment had to admit that it was a debacle, that it was a disaster, and that it has shaken this presidential campaign, and it has completely transformed it and turned it upside down in terms of how it's being looked at, how it's being considered, and most importantly, how it's being covered by the media. And that I can give you some insight on, because I've worked in the media pretty much my whole career, many decades. When I watched that debate, I was sad because I didn't see a politician struggling. I didn't see a politician failing. I didn't see a politician letting down his supporters. I didn't see a politician destroying his career. I saw a person in crisis. I saw a person who needs help, who needs care, and a person who I don't think is getting it. We're hearing about the aftermath of this debate in terms of political gamesmanship. Well, should Biden drop down for the good of his party? Should he drop down for the good of his country? Who can win? Who could take his place? Who can beat Trump if he's not in? Can he still beat Trump? Was it a bad night? You're hearing all these different excuses and these different theories, but nobody is talking. I haven't heard it yet. I haven't heard one person say, I think Joe Biden needs help. He needs care. Not President Biden. To me, after that debate, I don't look at him anymore as President Biden. I look at him as Joe Biden, a man who needs help and care. I'm not saying that he is completely devoid of mental capacity. What I saw brought back memories to me, because about 20 years ago, I had to make what was and still is, and I would venture to say will always be, the most difficult, painful, but necessary decision that I ever made in my life. 20 years ago, it became clear, and this was 20 years ago when there was still a huge stigma and a lot of ignorance and misinformation about mental capacity in terms of dementia, in terms of Alzheimer's. And even though in the next 20 years, we still don't have any kind of a cure. We don't really have any kind of real medical breakthroughs that are stopping. There are some drugs that may have this and may do that. But in the last 20 years, we still haven't made the advances to either treat or even cure dementia or Alzheimer's. But one good thing I think has happened in the last 20 years is that we have more understanding, more knowledge, and more empathy for this disease, for those who have it, and for those, yes, those loved ones, those family and friend members who have to be only involved as well as watch someone that they love and respect slowly decline mentally. I had to make this decision. I watched my father go through dementia. And ultimately, a couple years later, my mom too. But first it was my father. And as I said, at this time 20 years ago, there wasn't a lot of general knowledge or understanding about Alzheimer's. People at that time were still not experiencing it on as a regular basis as we are now. In the last 20 years, people have been living longer, which means the potential for more people to have dementia and have Alzheimer's is growing because it is a disease that tends to set in old age. Yes, we used to call it going senile and things like that. But 20 years ago, there was still an ignorance as to what it was. You'd heard about it. You may have heard some people that had it. You heard about how it ravaged people, but it really hadn't touched as many people personally in their lives as possible or at that time. So it wasn't viewed as a major health type of crisis. But in the 20 years since this occurred to my family, it has. So at least from my standpoint, I'm hoping that people that are dealing now with loved ones who have dementia, Alzheimer's, that their plight, that their situation in handling it and coping with it for a loved one is easier than I had it. Because as I said, when it happened to my dad 20 years ago, there wasn't that general understanding. And so I had to rely, as I've said many times on this podcast, I rely on the experts. This comes back to my media training of being objective. I try as much as I can. Don't misunderstand me. I am an emotional person, no question. Sometimes overly emotional. But I do believe when you have to make a crucial and important decision, especially one that might not just might, but will affect somebody's life, you certainly have to take into consideration your emotional attachment. But the most important part of this is to also tap into your objective side. Because if you're just guided by your emotions, most likely you're going to make the wrong decision, because you will be blind to a lot of fact, because fact gets into the way. And your emotions take over, your optimism, your hopes. You don't want to hear negativity. But to make a smart, educated decision, you must look at the facts. And so, like I said, whether there's a plumbing problem in my house or an electrical problem or whatever, a legal problem, I don't pretend to know what is best. I put my faith in the experts. This is what I talked about in voting for somebody. Whether you believe politicians are crooked or not and all those cliches, that's fine. But at the end of the day, that's their job. They are consumed with information coming at them constantly about different issues, different solutions, different problems. That's what they do. So you can argue that, well, politicians are a bunch of jerks. I'm not disputing that. Many of them are. But they still have more information and more data than I do. I can have an opinion, but as I said before, when I vote for somebody, I vote for somebody that I feel that I can trust, who can make a good, educated decision on a topic. They may even not agree with me, but they may be able to convince me based on their knowledge of the subject, which is much deeper than mine, that this is the right way to go. And I respect that. That's the type of people that I vote for. And those are the type of people that when there's a health issue, as I said, or there's an issue with plumbing, or I don't call a plumber to fix my electrical problem, or vice versa. I don't call an electrician to undo the clog in my sink. I don't call a painter to fix my gutter. I call an expert. And in the case of my dad's situation, I had to rely on the doctors who have dealt with people with dementia, certainly more than I ever had, and certainly more than anybody in my family ever had. They know the symptoms, they know the causes, they don't know how to fix it, but they have dealt with hundreds of cases. And they see the similarities. For me to look at one situation, my dad's, and believe that I have all the answers, that I know that I am absolutely correct, that's folly. That's silly. I always talk about how I watch Columbo. All the world really comes down to a good Columbo episode, folks. But no, I remember in an episode, it was actually, I believe it's the first episode. It wasn't even really the first Columbo show. It was the Columbo film called Prescription Murder with Peter Falk and Gene Barry. And Gene Barry is the killer, and he's a very smart psychiatrist who believes that he, like all the Columbo villains, believes that he has committed the perfect crime. And Columbo hasn't accused him yet. He's just doing his little playful scratching at the surface to try to see if he can find some information from somebody that he already suspects did it. But he doesn't let on early on. And so the two are getting into a conversation. And he asks Gene Barry, the psychiatrist, who is very smart and very with an inflated ego. And he says, well, and Columbo suspects him, but he's not letting on yet. He says, well, how would, you know, you're a psychiatrist. Help me with this. I'm trying, you know, because his wife was killed. So he's having to talk to Gene Barry. And even though he suspects him, he's pretending that they're both allies trying to find the real killer. He says, well, Doc, can you help me? I mean, what kind of mind might this killer have? And Gene Barry very smugly says, even you probably won't be able to catch him because he's too smart. He's talking about himself at this point, of course. And Peter Falk says something very interesting. Columbo says, well, you know, Doc, that's true, but the thing is that in my business, police detective, we deal with murder cases every day. We deal with murder plots that have gone wrong every day. And we begin to see a pattern where the people make their mistake, and they inevitably make some mistake. So we have the advantage of knowing the trends, of knowing where the problems are, and looking at every murder case to see, are there any similarities in terms of motive, in terms of execution, to show who might be the most obvious suspect? Whereas the murderer, he or she has just one chance to get it right. We have thousands of examples of how other murderers have gotten it wrong to inform us to look for those different clues and those different mistakes. Some that may be very slight, but they're still a mistake that exposes who did it. But that murderer, for the most part, hopefully, this is the first time they've ever killed anybody. This is the first time that they may have planned their murder. And even though they think they've got every detail covered to throw suspicion off of them, this is their only shot. And the police have seen that even the quote-unquote perfect murders, most of the time, have some flaw. And so Columbo's point is, well, you know, yes, he might be smart, and he may have committed a crime that seems to be the perfect crime, but in dissecting all this, the police have a great advantage because we have studied and broken thousands of cases collectively. And that murderer has to get it right on the first shot. And that's kind of the way that I view this in terms of, in the case of my dad's situation, I have to rely on the experts. I have to rely on the doctors because they have studied, they have treated, they have observed many, many patients with dementia, all different types. Don't forget, Alzheimer's is a type of dementia. It's not different from dementia. It's a type of dementia. A lot of people don't know that. Because of my dad and my mom's situation dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's, I worked in the public relations department for the Alzheimer's Association for a year or so because I was driven to find out more. I saw what it did to my family, to my parents, and to my extended family, and I wanted more information so there might be ways that I could help to help others not make the mistakes that happened in our family. So I had to rely on the doctors. Even 20 years ago, when a lot of information and a lot of knowledge about dementia and Alzheimer's was still not as collected or accepted or known at the time, they still were miles and years ahead of my knowledge. So I had to put my faith and trust in their diagnoses. And not just one doctor. It wasn't just one doctor. I had my father checked by several doctors, had several opinions done. And the results were not even close. Every doctor at various hospitals around the city, every diagnosis was the same. Well, of course he has dementia. I mean, that was the way it was brought up. It wasn't, does he? I was hoping, well, do you think he has dementia? And they looked at me like, well, of course he has dementia. The question is how severe it is. But there's no question he has it. And so I had to make a very difficult situation. Because at the same time that my father, who had been showing some definite behavioral changes over some period of time. But at that time, I didn't know about this. I mean, my dad had a temper, and so when he was acting different ways, you just put it down to that. But now in retrospect, as I take a step back and look at what had been happening perhaps 6 months or even a year before that, I realized that there was something going on. And even he, I believe, knew it. One time we were driving. I was driving with him in our car. We were going out for some dinner with my parents, my wife and I, and we were driving, and now we are in my parents' neighborhood where I was born, where I lived, you know, first 27, 28 years, where they had lived for more than 40. And we were at a stoplight, and my dad was in the back seat. I was driving. And at the time, I thought it was a joke. But in retrospect, I look back and say, wow, I think he was trying to tell us something without telling us. We were at a stoplight, literally three or four blocks away from their house, this neighborhood where he's lived for, you know, 35, 40 years. And out of the clear blue sky, he said, you know, if you let me out of the car right now, I wouldn't know how to get home. And we just kind of laughed. But I believe, based on after talking to my mom after this, that my mom said, well, sometimes he'd go out to the store and he wouldn't come back for 4 or 5 hours. And she didn't know where we was. Clearly, he was getting lost. Clearly, he was losing his mental capacity. He was from that older generation where people don't want to admit that they're sick or that they're, you know, losing their wits, if you will, whatever you want to call it. But when he said that, at the time, it was kind of a joke. My dad had a funny sense of humor. But now back in retrospect, I say, wow, he was trying to tell me something. And as I said, what became difficult is that it came to a head with some very scary situations, some paranoia and some very stressful situations, because now it was just my mom and dad living alone. Very stressful for my mom, and to the point where she got afraid. And so at the same time, and I don't know if this actually even had some kind of an effect on her, but suddenly my mom, on her birthday, I got a phone call that said, we are in the hospital. What do you mean, we? And she said, well, I had a little heart issue, and then your dad said that his knee hurt, and so they brought us both in. So on my mom's birthday, I went to the hospital, and there were my mom and dad in the same room. Happy birthday, Mom. As my mom's situation with her heart was corrected, she had a stent put in. That was physical. That was a physical problem, which could be treated and hopefully cured. But while my dad was there, the nurses and the doctors, while he said his knee hurt, his knee didn't hurt. He didn't hurt his knee. When he saw that my mom might have to go to the hospital, he realized that he would have to be home alone, and he was afraid to be home alone. So he pretended that he hurt his knee so he could go to the hospital with her. He knew his situation. I was unaware of it. I was getting bits and pieces, but I wasn't living with them every day. But I was beginning to realize something was going on here. So while he was in the hospital, the nurses and the doctors were observing his behavior, treating him for a bad knee that he said was hurt. But it became clear after a couple of x-rays, there was nothing wrong with his knee, but I got a phone call. And the doctor said, I need to talk to you about your father. He said, there's nothing wrong with his knee, but we have observed him over the last couple of days, and it seems pretty clear that he has dementia. He's got some memory problems and some behavioral problems. It's clear he's got dementia. Whoa. Wow. Imagine getting that phone call. Both of your parents now are sick. One physically sick, with a heart issue, which is, I don't even care in today's world, even a stent, that's serious stuff. She had a heart attack. She had blockage. And she was an older woman. But now my dad has a neurological disease, which is filled with mystery and cannot be cured. It can be treated. It can be cared for. but it can't be cured. And my mom and dad don't live with us, and so what are we going to do for a living situation and a care situation? This was a complete shift in our lives as we knew it. And it happened with one phone call in one day, out of the blue. And so I had to make a very difficult situation, a difficult decision. And at the time, once again, 20 years ago, the idea of putting an elderly person in a nursing home, especially with an older views for years, for decades, the implication of a nursing home is a death sentence. Now, today we know, once again, in 20 years, we're understanding the limitations. We are creating services. We are creating environments for people with dementia or so to be able to live something of a normal life. Not a normal life, but we have assisted living places. We have people that provide care, either full-time or part-time. But there's much more of a support system in place now 20 years ago. And more importantly, culturally, there is more, at least general knowledge and more acceptance of realities. We still don't like to talk about it. In many ways, we still don't want to admit it. Because believe me, there is nothing more painful, as I said before, to watch somebody that you have known and loved your whole life and to see them, that personality, the essence of them, slowly fade away. But that's the reality. And as much as you want that person to just change and have this go away and become their old selves, you can't wish that to happen. In your heart, you would love for that to happen. Emotionally, you would love for that to happen, or at least hope that the progression of the disease stops and they stay even at this point, but that's not reality. You can't make a decision based on hopes and emotions. You've got to make decisions based on realities. For the care of that person, because you're being selfish if you want that person to get better, because they're not going to. But in your mind, you want them to be that other person, but that's not fair to them. You're trying to make yourself feel good so that your world is normal. But you're putting a huge stress on them. You're expecting and wanting and hoping that they will get better and putting them in situations that can be dangerous to their health and their well-being and to other people because they can no longer function in a normal situation. So you can't keep them in a normal situation. Someone's going to get hurt. The person themselves, the person they're living with, other people outside. We heard about people with dementia and Alzheimer's wandering. There's a huge responsibility. And it's not just to the person themselves, which of course is paramount, but the entire situation, those around the people and those in the society. You know, I always talk about, I don't have kids. I get it. But when I see somebody that's raising a kid, we see what bad parenting does. Bad parenting leads to teenage kids shooting up people at parades. I mean, yes, there might be some mental disorder, but that wasn't that the job of the parents to identify that and do something so that that person does not only hurt themselves, but hurt others? There's a decision that wasn't made. That was a decision that, you know, on any of these people that shoot people, that was a decision made from the heart, not from the mind. These decisions that we make for people's health have tentacles that affect many people. As I said, I don't know if my mom's heart situation was precipitated by the stress that she was in living with my dad, who was slowly beginning to lose his cognitive abilities. And his temper would flare up and he would act crazy. I don't know if that situation of living with that, fearing it, wondering, added stress to her, which gave her a heart attack. But you have to understand that there's tentacles here. And so I had to make, as I said before, the most difficult decision I ever had to make at that point in my life, and I hope it remains the most difficult decision I ever have to make, because it was gut-wrenching. Because here was a man who was a vibrant, funny, loved friend, family member, brother, uncle, father, big personality. People loved to be around him, always the life of the party. But suddenly those aspects weren't there anymore. And sadly, the temper in him through the dementia began to be elevated. And that was showing up more. But his mental capacity was just declining. And my mom now had to recover physically from her heart ailment. And so I had to make this painful decision to put my father in an assisted living facility and basically split them up. And my mom couldn't take care of herself either. So my mom came to live with my wife and I, and my dad was living in a nursing home close by so that we could visit him. And my mom would go there every day when she finally, you know, recovered. But basically, from that night when my mom had the heart attack, their lives and our lives completely changed overnight. My dad, when he left that house, when my mom had the heart attack and the ambulance came, and they went to the hospital, and he said he hurt his knee, which he didn't, he never went back home. He never went home. He was in the hospital. He went to another facility for dementia testing, two facilities, in fact. And after the diagnoses were identical, he had to be put into an assisted living area and then, you know, a full-blown kind of dementia Alzheimer's wing of a facility. Not easy to make that decision. Not easy. I mean, think about what I had to do here. I was not only putting my dad in this facility, but basically my mom and dad had been married for over 40 years, and suddenly they were not going to be living together anymore. My mom, to her credit, it was a 3-year odyssey. My dad finally passed away, or a 2-year, about a year and a half. He was a sick man, physically and mentally. And about a year and a half after he went into the facility, he passed away. But my mom, I don't think, missed a day visiting him. And when I asked her, "Mom, you can take a day off just for your own well-being. You know, sometimes Dad doesn't even know that you were there. If you skip a day or two, just to get away from that stress of going to the hospital and things like that." But she looked me straight in the eye and she said, "I have to be with him." Who knows how long he's going to be here? And so it was not an easy situation or an easy decision. But I'll tell you, at the end of the day, my dad was cared for. He didn't hurt himself. He didn't hurt anyone else. He got medical care. He was comfortable. And when he passed away peacefully. And I don't know, but I think that those results were pretty good when you consider the situation that he was in. It wasn't an easy decision, but it was the necessary decision. And sadly, my mom passed away about a year and a half after he did. And she began to show signs of dementia and Alzheimer's. And I was ready to make another difficult decision. But then she sadly had a major stroke and passed away. But my point was, I had to make a decision not based just on my emotions and my heart, but on reality. I had to take care of my dad. I didn't look at it as an obligation. I looked at it as a responsibility, as something that was a part of my life. My parents took care of me when I needed them as a baby and a small child and raising me. And now it came full circle. They made decisions for me when I was unable to make my own decisions as a baby and a young child. They made decisions for me out of their love and responsibility to their child. And now my dad couldn't make the decisions for himself. And neither of them really could. And so now it was my turn to give back to them. And I felt that they made the right decisions for me in my life. I'm happy with who I am. And so I wanted to make sure that I made the best decision for them when they couldn't make those decisions for themselves anymore. They may not have been the popular decision. They may not have been the easy decision, but they were the necessary decision. And sadly, there was a detrimental side effect to that decision. Sadly, my father's side of the family, which is really my only family, my mother's family was very small, and we didn't really have much contact with them. A lot of them passed away. So my family, pretty much growing up, was my father's family. We went all the holidays, you name it. My father's family was my extended family. We went on vacations. We did everything. Because there was such a lack of knowledge and understanding of dementia 20 years ago, because there was a very old-fashioned view of nursing homes and facilities by people of an older generation, because 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, they weren't. They were places where people were basically sent to be cared for before they died. But things have changed, thankfully. But there were still these very old-held impressions and views. And so when I had to make the decision to put my dad in a facility, my dad's family, mainly his two sisters, were very much against that decision. They felt that he didn't need to go to a facility. That I don't know what they thought the other options were. We certainly couldn't afford 24 hours care that he would get in a facility out of our pocket. I certainly didn't want to. My mom could not take care of him. We didn't have room in our house to take care of both of them. It was a struggle, believe me, with my mom just living with us. It totally changed my wife and I's lifestyle for 3 years. The whole odyssey of my parents' illnesses was 3 years, and it was a complete upheaval of everything. Once again, I'm not complaining. It was my responsibility, but my point is, it wasn't easy. There's no way we could have had both of them living here. Impossible. Because mainly my dad's situation needed professional 24-hour care, which we cannot provide. We are not professionals. As I said before, I depend on the professionals, whether it's doctors, whether it's caregivers, healthcare professionals. They do this all the time. I don't know how to do it. I had to rely on them. But sadly, my father's family were so angered my decision. And I understand it from an emotional standpoint. I get it. This was their older brother who they looked up to, who they loved dearly, who, as I said before, was so loved and was the life of the party. And so they in their minds had this vision of who he was from, you know, his whole life. But at this point, that was not him anymore. And at this point, 20 years ago, I don't think they were willing to accept it. They were in denial. They didn't want it to be true. They thought he's just depressed or something. They didn't want to admit the severity of his disease because it's painful to acknowledge it and see it happen. And you don't want to see someone you love go through this. But you can't, as I said before, let your emotions supersede the facts and the realities. Because I believe you're being selfish. You're as I said before, you're trying to put this person in a position that they can no longer handle for your good. Oh, well, at least he's at home and he's fine. But he's not fine. And being at home offers more dangers than safety. What if he got out of the house and walked away in the middle of the night? What would happen? He needed 24-hour care. That was not just a surmising. That's what the professionals at two or three different testings and facilities came back with. Unequivocal. No, well, maybe. There were no maybes. No, he's got dementia and he needs 24-hour care. Everyone said that. And so sadly, I was divorced from my family, if you will. I was kicked out of the family for making this decision. And I basically I've seen a couple of my cousins over the last couple of years, but nothing of any substance. But I have not been to a family function in 20 years. I am not really a member of, I have no family. And it's very sad because I loved my family and I felt that I enjoyed being in their company and being a part of them and loved them all very much. But now it's been 20 years. It'll be 21 years, actually, pretty soon. And I mean, that's 20 years of life that's been lived. That we don't have any memories. We've made no new memories in the last 20 years. Whatever memories we have are from 20 years and older. There have been children, there have been grandchildren that have been born over the last 20 years that I've never met, that I don't know. They don't know me. I could see them walking down the street and wouldn't even know it's them. It's very sad. It's unfortunate. But that was my family's decision. And ultimately, I certainly tried to present my case, but it wasn't being heard. But at the end of the day, I had to choose the health and well-being of my dad over the wishes of my family, which I felt were not in his best interests. They were there to be emotional, but in terms of his well-being and his care, it was not a tenable situation to have him at home for anybody. Emotionally, physically, financially. But that didn't seem to care because they had this view of being put in a nursing home. But I had to make that decision. I made the decision based on what my father's needs were, not what his family's needs were for him, not what my needs may have been for him, but what his needs were. And that was the decision I made. And as I said, most difficult decision in my life, had many tentacles. It had many adverse repercussions. But the main focus of the decision was his health, his care. And I don't have any regrets about that. It's sad what has happened in the aftermath of that. It's sad that I had to be ostracized for taking care of my father, but that's the way things go sometimes. I had to accept that and move on. It's sad. I still miss my family, but at the same time, I feel confident that I made the right choice for my dad. And you say, Jim, why are you telling us all this? To get back to what I was talking about at the very beginning about Joe Biden. Joe Biden needs care. Joe Biden needs people to not think about political or presidential politics or political gamesmanship or strategies. I see an 81-year-old man who needs help, who needs care. I'm not saying that he's feeble-minded and that he's a doddering old fool. No. But he's definitely diminished and diminishing, and it's not going to get any better. It's not going to stay the same. He's not going to be as sharp as he was last week, next week, and certainly not in 4 years. We can hope, we can pray. But this is serious stuff, folks. And we have to look at reality. And I'm not talking about the reality of who's in the White House. I'm talking about a guy who needs his family or his friends or anyone who loves him to step up and make the hardest decision of their life and tell him and convince him that he needs to get help. This is not about presidencies anymore. This is about a man who is sick and needs care. It was sad to watch. Yes, it's sad for anyone when you see this. It's even worse when it's on international television. And while everybody for the last couple of weeks is debating of all these political scenarios, I'm not hearing anybody say, this man needs help. He needs care. He needs to not be running the most stressful job in the entire universe. The hardest job in the world. He should not be in the position of having to be in the most stressful, important job that has implications around the world for everybody. Do you understand the weight of the presidency and the importance of it? This man is sick. You cannot deny what you saw. And if you did, you're in major denial. I don't care how much you hate Donald Trump. Have some compassion for Joe Biden. The person, not the president, not the politician. The 81-year-old man who was up there basically, when I watched that debate, that was a cry for help. And I'm not seeing anybody in his family. I'm not seeing anybody in his circle of friends or his advisors or anybody standing up and making the difficult decision. Oh, well, you know, he won't drop out. They're saying he's too stubborn. This isn't about dropping out of a campaign. This is about getting help. Joe Biden should be resting. He shouldn't be in a stressful situation. He still has capabilities. He should be enjoying the rest of his years in a stress-free environment, surrounded by the people he lived, getting the care he needs. He shouldn't be traveling around the world in 15 time zones in the most stressful position job in the world. It's a stressful job for somebody in their 40s or 50s who have their mental capacity. Why isn't anybody talking about Joe Biden, the man? Joe Biden, the 81-year-old man who is in need of help and care, who is in a position of declining mental capability. There's no question about that. It's obvious. It's been happening for years. The White House has been covering it up. The media that hates Donald Trump has been covering it up. And now it's the emperor has no clothes. And have you seen the shift in how the media is covering this story now? Now suddenly they're all about his mental capabilities. They wouldn't mention that 3 weeks ago. Nikki Haley got in trouble about a year ago, basically saying, which I've been saying for at least a year, that Joe Biden would, if he was elected, would never finish his last term, his next term. And she was hammered by George Stephanopoulos and many other, you know, Democratic supporting journalists who hate Trump. Well, what do you base that on? And he got belligerent with her. And a year later, you can't unsee what we saw. You can't make excuses for it. It was not a bad night. It was not a cold. He had such a cold. Why was he out the next day giving a speech? I'm not saying that he's completely incapacitated, but he's definitely on a decline, on a fast decline that's not going to get any better. As I said before, the reality of the situation, take a step back. Joe Biden's situation and condition is only going to get worse than it was 2 weeks ago, not better. Every day, every month, every year. I basically have been telling my friends over the last year, once again, this is not about politics. I told you, I'm a registered Democrat. I'm a liberal-minded person. But I'm taking a step back, and I was telling people that Joe Biden should not be the nominee. He's not capable anymore. This was a year ago. And I said, if Joe Biden becomes president again, if he wins another term, and this is a year before this debate, I said only three possible things can happen. Inevitable. Bank it. Bet your house on it. And the three things that I said a year ago to my friends, who looked at me kind of, what are you talking about? I'm not saying that anymore. I'm not talking about Joe Biden, the politician. I'm not talking about the only chance to beat Donald Trump. I'm not talking about politics. I'm talking about a very sick man. And here's the reality. If Joe Biden stays in this race and is elected, three things will happen. One of three things. Have to. Inevitable. He will either have to resign because his mental capabilities will continue to decline as they have been, and they will get even worse in the next 4 years. So if he is elected, he will resign before his term is up because it will become too obvious. Second, he will be removed from office by the 25th Amendment because of his incapacitation, because his mental decline will be such that it will be too obvious and that the Congress will have to get involved and remove him from office. So either he'll resign because of his mental deficiencies, and as they continue to decline, he will be removed from office with the 25th Amendment if he wins another term, or third, he will pass away. But he will not finish his next term. Because the man is sick. One way or the other, he will not finish his next term. But that's beside the point. If people are worried about that, you don't tell me you love Joe Biden. I hear so many of these political pundits saying, I love Joe Biden. If you love Joe Biden, you would call his family, you would call his friends, or you would call him and tell him, and stop this denial, stop this cover-up, stop this delusion, and face reality. Not only does the man need to drop out of this campaign, not because he's a bad president, regardless of what you think about that, he needs to be in a situation where he has no stress and he's cared for. And he's allowed to live his life with his mental situation as it declines, so that he can lead a safe life that is safe for him, safe for others, and is peaceful, and enjoy the last days or years, hopefully, of his life. Somebody around him needs to step up and make that decision. For Joe Biden, this is not a political decision. Politics be damned. We're talking about a person's life right here. And I don't hear anybody talking about that. Joe Biden's a sick man. Joe Biden needs care. Joe Biden needs to be cared for. His loved ones, his family, his friends, they need to take control of the situation, as difficult as it is. Oh, well, Joe Biden will never quit. He's stubborn. I got news for you. He's not as stubborn as my dad was. And when I made the decision to put my dad in the nursing home, believe me, he wasn't happy. And he called me some names. But I had to withstand that because it was the right decision. Nobody was more stubborn than my dad. Joe Biden was not more stubborn than my dad, but I had to step up and make the hardest decision of my life, and Joe Biden's family needs to step up and make the hardest decision of their life. Because this is not about politics. This is not about White House power and who owns the presidency and all this other BS. What I saw at that debate was a person crying for help. Whether he knew it or not, his situation was crying for help. He may be too stubborn to admit it. He may have too big of an ego to admit it. He may want to be the president. I understand that. But somebody needs to step up and make the right decision. Repercussions be damned. Because don't blame, I don't blame Joe Biden. I feel sorry for Joe Biden. If you want to blame somebody, blame the Democratic Party for putting Joe Biden in this position to begin with. Because Joe Biden, at his age, should never have been the president to begin with. All the Democrats had to do in 2016 was elect Hillary Clinton, who was a first lady, a senator, and the Secretary of State. And the Democratic Party could not elect her over Donald Trump, who had never run for any office in his life. The Democratic Party could not elect the first woman president whose resume is better than three quarters of the people that ever have been president, if not more. Few presidents had that kind of resume that Hillary Clinton had. Senator, Secretary of State, and First Lady for 8 years. Been around the White House, been around it all. And the Democratic Party could not get her elected to be the first woman president. Don't blame Donald Trump for the overturning of Roe versus Wade. Blame the Democratic Party, because if the Democratic Party had gotten Hillary Clinton elected president, she would have named the three justices. And women, and abortion rights and women health care rights would have been covered for the next 50 or 60 years, just as the way they're complaining now about the Trump appointees. Hillary Clinton, obviously, would have had three Supreme Court justice picks, and she would have picked three pro-choice people. And abortion rights would have been solidified for the next 50 or 60 years. So where were the women voters then voting for their rights? Why didn't you vote for Hillary Clinton? Because women over 50 didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. If all the women voted for the first woman president, if all the women voted for women's rights, if abortion was their most important issue, then you had to vote for Hillary Clinton. Because that would have solidified Roe versus Wade. Donald Trump didn't pull any. Once again, I'm not supporting Trump. I'm just telling you the truth here. I'm telling you the facts. Donald Trump did not pull any behind the scenes chicanery when he named those three Supreme Court justices during the election, during the campaign, before he was elected. He put out a list. This is a list of the people of which I will choose from if I am elected president, who I will choose from to fill any Supreme Court opening that happens during my presidency. He released the list to the public. All of them were conservative. All of them were considered pro-life justices. And so if you cared so much about abortion rights and Roe v. Wade, even if you hated Hillary, even if you hated her pantsuits and her haircuts and her voice and her laugh, whatever it was that you didn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, if abortion rights, which now seem to be so paramount in people's minds, why? Because they've been taken away. Hillary Clinton was your choice because Donald Trump already told you, listen, folks, if you elect me, here's the list of people I'm going to choose from. And he did. Pure, total transparency. Why didn't the Democratic Party focus on that, on one issue? Because they thought that Donald Trump was a joke. They didn't take him seriously. And the media didn't take him seriously for the first 6 months of his candidacy in 2015. And they put him on TV stations for free all that summer. And they were shocked by September when his message started to take hold. And they were like, wait a minute. We were just putting Donald Trump on television here in the summer of 2015 because, it's summer. No one cares about presidential politics yet. This was just a distraction. It was just a carnival. Your Chuck Todds and your Joe Scarboroughs and your George Stephanopoulos, they had Donald Trump on all the time. Free publicity when his campaign first started because he was a sideshow. He was good entertainment. He got us ratings. Little did they know that his message would actually start to resonate with people. They created Donald Trump's political career. The media did. And the Democratic Party did. So don't get mad at Joe Biden. Get mad at the Democratic Party. That's why I said earlier, I feel like I'm a man without a party. They've abandoned many of the values that they used to stand for. And they've done a horrible job of getting candidates who can win the election. Joe Biden should never have been the candidate. But they had 19 people in 2016, late 2015, who wanted to run for president on the Democratic side. And when they had the first debate, it was painfully clear that not one of those people could beat Donald Trump. If you watched MSNBC after the first debate, when they were all up on the stage, it looked like a funeral. Because they all realized not one person on that stage could beat Donald Trump in 2020. It was 2019, I'm sorry. In 2019, they realized he couldn't beat him. That's why they had to take Joe Biden and mold him into a moderate for the election. And then they had COVID. The Democrats were going to nominate Bernie Sanders as the presidential nominee, if not for Biden in 2020. Bernie Sanders could not have won a national election, and the Democratic establishment knew that. But instead of 4 years when Trump was president, instead of impeaching him and trying to get him to resign and talking about his mental capacity and all this bickering that went nowhere, the Democratic Party should have found a candidate in 2016 on January 22nd after Donald Trump was inaugurated. The Democratic Party should have found a candidate to run against him in 2020. They should have been running him for 4 years so that when the election came, they would have had a viable candidate who the entire party supported, and they would have beat Trump. But instead, they played all these games. Let's impeach him. We'll try to get him to resign. And they were just throwing all this mud at the wall, and none of it stuck. Instead of doing what they were supposed to do, was get a viable candidate. Instead of finding a 78-year-old man who had run for president twice before when he was a young man and lost within the first two or three primaries, and was the vice president for 8 years and was never considered to be the heir apparent to Barack Obama. Why? Joe Biden was not a consensus candidate. He was a compromise candidate. He was a desperation candidate. So don't blame Joe Biden. I feel sorry for Joe Biden. I feel sorry for the position he's in. But blame the Democratic Party. Don't blame Joe Biden. Take care of Joe Biden. Joe Biden needs help. Joe Biden needs care. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if he's going to drop out. I don't know if there's going to be another candidate. I don't know if Trump's going to win. I don't know. All I know is that right now there's a very sick man who needs help on the world stage. And I hope somebody gives it to him. Care for Joe Biden. You don't have to vote for Joe Biden. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 424. I'm Jim Tarano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears.